We'll take up as we had an act relating establishing the Alaska Racing Commission and authorizing pari mutuel wagering at sanctioned events. I had sent this into a subcommittee consisting of Representative Boyer as chair. Representative Boyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Before turning this over to the sponsor of the bill to describe specifically the changes that we are proposing in a Finance Committee CS, I thought I would take a moment to talk about the fiscal note, which is considerably pared down from the original fiscal note proposed by the Department of Revenue, and it's a little higher than the original fiscal note proposed by the sponsor. However, I feel that it is a good middle ground fiscal note with no fiscal impact in FY88 because we assume that the bill will not be passed until next year, and so the fiscal impact occurs in FY89 through 91, and you all should have a copy of the fiscal note in your packet. It shows a slower startup, obviously, with regard to events. The expenses will occur in the second quarter of FY89, and that we won't have any actual staff on board until the third or the actual fourth quarter or third quarter of FY89, when we will hire an office manager. There may be some additional impact to the public safety and the Department of Law's budgets, because each of those are required to perform certain functions here, the Department of Public Safety background checks and Department of Law to draft some regulations. So while those are not reflected at this time in the fiscal note, there may be some impact in the future. And it was the subcommittee's feeling that we could deal with those issues next year if the bill continues to move. And with that, I'd like to turn the meeting over to the sponsor of the bill to walk us through the proposed changes in the Finance CS.
Representative Larson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I, too, want to thank the chairman of the subcommittee. I think we have done a good job here in addressing all of the concerns that were expressed by Sally Smith from the Department of Revenue when she was here the last time. If I may take just a minute or so, I'd like to walk through those changes and then, of course, answer any questions that any members of the committee may have. But on the first page, there was a concern about the makeup of the Alaska Racing Commission. There, of course, we put specific expertise within that makeup to conform to what she had requested at that time, with one member having experience in law enforcement, one member experience in bookkeeping and accounting, one member with experience in pari-mutuel wagering or horse racing or dog racing, and, of course, then two members from the public. On page 2, down to line 18, we had a word that said the governor may summarily suspend, and she was concerned about what the actual definition of that was, so we put the definition in, making it immediately so that there could be no doubt. On page 3, we addressed the concern about who would have oversight in relation to the commission as it drafted the regulations. So there we stated, of course, that the commission shall, in consultation with the Attorney General, adopt to give that added oversight. The next major concern that in the original draft, we didn't clearly distinguish between what would be, say, the license or the permitting system. So what we have done here is established a system by which the overall operator would have to obtain a license. That is the same person who, of course, would have to be approved by the voters of the municipality in order to operate within a municipality. And then for everyone else, from the trainers to the jockeys to the concessionaires and so forth, we no longer call that a license, but to clearly identify it, we call it a special permit. On page 4, we deal with the annual report to conform with the April the 15th, or the IRS date, as she requested at that time. Also on page 4, down line 20 and 21 and 22, we gave a clarification. There, by regulation, impose an admission surcharge for a race not to exceed $1 without regards to whether the race meet operator charges an admission fee or not. In other words, that the commission would have the ability to charge a $1 entrance fee And of course, we did not reflect that $1 within the fiscal note either, but that, of course, has the potential of raising several thousands of dollars each year. On page 5, we simply kind of clarified there the race meet operator's license, and that no one could conduct a race meet without a race meet operator's license, and also then who contracted for the concessions, and of course that would be the race meet operator who has obtained the license. And then it also defines who would have to obtain those special permits. There in the middle of the page 5. On page 6, once again, we simply dealt there with on line 11 to clearly define what is the minimum of the pool that must be returned to those people who are doing the wagering. We require that the race meet operator give a report within 30 days of the race meet. And we also then provide for the oversight to the race meets by the commission. And I think the only other changes we made is clarification on page 8, which has to do with definitions to clearly identify the race meet operator and what a special permit is. And of course, to clearly define that public safety will do the investigation of everyone before they are allowed to partake in any way within a race meet. And on the last page, page 9, line 5, it used to say that the governor shall make the initial appointments of members of the Alaska Racing Commission within 60 days. Upon the request, we changed that to 120 days to allow for a full and complete background investigation of those members of the commission who would be appointed by the governor. So that is roughly the changes that we have made to conform with suggestions in relation to the bill when it was before us the last time. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I'd be happy to answer any questions that anyone may have.
Is there any questions from the committee before I ask for a motion to adopt the committee substitute? Hearing none.
Mr. Chairman, I'd move and ask unanimous consent to adopt the CS for House Bill number 32, finance dated 4787.
Is there anybody from the public that would like to testify on the committee substitute for House Bill number 32? Is there any questions of the committee?
413, excuse me.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just had a question on this fiscal note. I didn't see who was prepared by. I was looking at it. Was it this prepared by Department of Revenue or?
Mr. Chairman, that was prepared by my staff and the staff of the sponsor, and it's a middle ground between the original proposed by the department and that proposed by the sponsor.
I will be signing the fiscal note that has come out of the subcommittee for 54.5. Representative Brown.
He clarified my question. Which was what date? The CS is dated 4/13.
Yeah.
Yes.
Any further questions?
I guess my question, Mr. Chairman, is as the department indicated that they're going to be able to, I assume there's some departmental oversight to the commission itself, and are they going to have the money to do that with this fiscal note?
Yes.
Mr. Chairman, I would echo the sponsor's comment that yes, they will be able to do it. We are also in the House side, we added one Games of Chance and Skill investigator to the department, and what we'd like to do, and as chairman of the budget subcommittee for the Department of Revenue, I'd like to see how that new investigator is able to deal with his or her responsibilities vis-a-vis games of chance and skill, and with and see how that works during the FY88, and if in fact there's additional time that could be allocated to this effort, I think that we can reshape the fiscal note to reflect that in the on the Senate side, and if we see that we need more, I think that there's time to do that. But I think we need to see what FY88 yields with regard to that new Games of Chance and Skill investigator in the department.
No further questions. Thank you.
No further questions.
Okay. Mr. Chairman.
Representative Larson.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I'd move that we move committee substitute for House Bill number 32, finance from committee with individual recommendations with the accompanying fiscal note.
Is there any objections? Hearing none, so ordered. The next bill will take up your House Concurrent Resolution Number 20 related to the Interim Commission on the Status of Healthcare and the Healthcare Industry in Alaska. This resolution requests the governor to establish an interim commission on health care. $80,000 is included in the House Hess budget for the commission. It is also hoped that $35,000 in private donations will materialize as well. Representative Boyer, Davis, Franken, Bonas is the sponsor of this resolution.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The idea for this commission was not my idea. It really was a product of discussions that I had with the Commissioner of Health and Social Services, who is here, and I think would, if necessary, answer questions of the committee members. But it's rather straightforward. We recognized in beginning to deal with the budget for the Department of Health and Social Services that there's a serious problem with regard to Medicaid rates and, in particular, rate increases and the general cost of health care in the state, and also the issue of access to health care in the state. And the resolution has four primary charges on page two. The legislature asks that the commission examine the causes of increases to health care costs, to review laws and regulations relating to health care in the state, to review the efforts of other states to contain health care and medical costs, and to make recommendations for legislation or regulations which might be necessary to reduce the cost of health care and to increase the effectiveness of health care delivery systems of to the residents of the state. It was my feeling that what we wanted to do was avoid in a time where we may well be finding ourselves with more people needing Medicaid services, in particular Medicare services in the state, that we come up with a way to provide more services with perhaps less money, and that's why we've addressed a lower cost and more entry or improved access to the whole system. And with that, rather than go on, I think I could perhaps answer questions or have the commissioner speak specifically to the need, because she does it certainly more eloquently than I.
Is there any question of the sponsor? Yes, Representative Wallace.
Thank you. Could you tell me what happens? I noted the $80,000 for the commission to travel and study this issue, but what happens if the other body doesn't adopt the $80,000?
Clearly, the first step would then be in conference to see if our members could prevail. Yesterday, however, in their adding exercise, they did add $80,000 for this commission on that side. So I think that there probably is a considerable interest in seeing the money added and the work continue on. But my hope is that it's there.
Thank you.
Commissioner, did you want to add something before we move this along? Representative Gordon Evans, sorry, did you want to testify on this? That's fine.
Mr. Chairman, members of the Finance Committee, my name is Gordon Evans, and I represent the Health Insurance Association of America, commonly known as HIAA. And HIAA is a national trade association of the private health insurance industry. And its members include more than 330 companies who write over 85% of the policies, or health insurance policies, that are written by private insurance companies in the United States. And approximately 200 of those member companies are licensed to do business in Alaska, including the top 20 companies in the state are members of HIA, including Aetna, which covers state employees. So this Blue Cross and Blue Shield are not members of HIAA. But HIA enthusiastically supports the concept of what HCR 20 is calling for, and the association believes that a health study such as this is long overdue and was especially beneficial to the legislature in its efforts to improve access to health care services in Alaska. And HIA would be happy to cooperate in such a study. The association has access to data relating to cost containment and the study of indigent care, which it would be glad to make available to this interim committee when and if it is established.
Thank you, sir. Any further questions? Thank you. Representative Boyer or Representative Rieger, before we move on, it.
Sure. Just one question. This might be to the commissioner, and it's not exactly on this, but in memory, it seems there was a report of the Medicaid Rate Commission just about the status of health care. Was there such a report that came out this spring? What was in that annual report, did you agree with any observations they made about the, that, I mean, in general, did you have any problems with that report?
For the record, I'm Myra Munson, Commissioner of Department of Health and Social Services. I'll admit to you, I have not read that report in great detail. I disagree with some of the information that I've been, that's generally in it. I would have to know what specific recommendation before I could comment, because I don't remember them in enough detail.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any further questions? Thank you. Representative Boyer.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to move and ask unanimous consent that House Concurrent Resolution Number 20 be reported out of committee with individual recommendations.
Is there any objections? Hearing none, so ordered. The next bill we'll take up is Committee Substitute for House Bill Number 145, Judiciary, an act relating to residential employing preference on certain natural resource projects on state land provided for an effective date. This particular bill would apply the state's local hire to oil and gas projects on state land. The requirements in this bill are similar to those in the law we passed last year establishing local hire on state projects. Zones would be established to determine whether preference of local hire residents would be applied. The Department of Labor is requesting approximately $46,200 to enforce the new law. The sponsors, Representative Donnelly, Boyer, Brown. Is anybody from Representative Donnelly's office here? Representative Boyer, did you have anything to comment?
Mr. Chairman, yes. If I could just note, Representative Donnelly was just getting started on a labor and commerce meeting, and they aren't going to be able to, he's going to try to break in a little bit to come up, but he was just calling the meeting to order down there.
Okay. Well, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to move the bill, unless it would be the druthers of the committee, to move it to the bottom of the calendar for Representative Donnelly. But
well, I'd like to try to get the bill. We've got eight bills in committee. If there's anybody that would like to testify on this bill, Representative Fischel. Is there anybody that would like to testify on this bill? Representative Boyer.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to move CS for HB 145 Judiciary from committee with individual recommendations.
Is there any objections? Hearing none, so ordered.
No.
The next bill we'll take up is House Bill Number 154. You have before you Committee Substitute for House Bill Number 154, State Affairs, an act related to the taxation of the income relating to individual tax credit and providing for an effective date. This particular bill is the governor's proposal for an income tax on individuals. It is a so-called progressive tax, and the higher your income, the more tax you pay. There are two rates: 3.2% of taxable income less than $30,906 plus 5.7% of the taxable income on $30,000 or more. The major change in the State Affairs CS is to exempt longevity bonus and permanent fund dividend income from the tax. The bill is expected to bring in approximately $82 million in new revenues for FY88. Revenue has asked for approximately $1.8 million to administer the new tax. At my request, Legislative Finance have reviewed the fiscal notes and recommends that we reduce the total appropriation to $1.3 million. Information on the fiscal note is in your particular packet. Here to testify on this bill is Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Hugh Malone, Commissioner-designate to the Department of Revenue. Mr. Chairman, I appreciate the committee scheduling the legislation. The income tax proposal that the governor has introduced to the legislature, and as it's been amended by committee, of course, is designed to help stabilize our state revenues and to provide some certainty in the provision of the public service budget in Alaska. Mr. Chairman, what I would like to do with your permission would be to have a brief presentation by Mr. Erickson of the Office of Management and Budget and Mr. John Hansen of the Department of Revenue, Mr. Erickson, to talk over briefly the overall place of the income tax in the state revenue picture and is important in the state's economic picture. And Mr. Hansen, who is head of the income tax project in the Department of Revenue, to go over briefly the mechanics of the bill and answer any specific questions on the incidence of the tax and the application of it. And if there are any questions at the end, I'd be glad to try to answer them. Is that an agreeable procedure, Mr. Chairman?
That is, Commissioner Desney Malone. I would be more than welcome the two members that you and perhaps with their presentation answer most of our questions that we have in mind. It's going to be the chair's desire that this particular bill move out of committee this afternoon with the individual recommendation, send it down to rules. Mr. Okay, would you, if you'll send your...
If it's agreeable, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to start with a brief presentation by Greg, who has been the member of the working group for the administration from the Office of Management and Budget, and he'd like to go through where the income tax would fit into the governor's overall budget plan for the state of Alaska, why it's being proposed that way, and how at least this administration views the economic effects of an income tax in Alaska at this time. Greg?
Mr. Chairman,
would you state your name and speak loud so I can get you on tape also, Greg, please? It's, you know, with the presentation away from the speaker, please.
My name is Greg Erickson. I'm senior economist with the Office of Management and Budget. Mr. Chairman, I know you have a heavy calendar here today, so we're going to move through this quickly, but there are two points that we think need to be explained and need to be emphasized, and that one is the role of the income tax in the overall fiscal situation and the consequences if this income tax is not adopted. And the second is the economic consequences to the state of Alaska of adopting the income tax or of not adopting it. And I'm going to move very quickly, so if there are questions, please feel free to interrupt me if that's okay. There are an infinite number of ways. I hope that I haven't scared everybody away here. There are an infinite number of ways that you can explain the state's fiscal situation, all of them, many of which are equally valid, because you can take money out of one place and put it in another or account for it differently. These charts are the charts that we prepared back in March after the March revenue forecasts were issued to show how we saw the state's fiscal condition at that time and our fiscal plan for the state's future. Some of the things have changed, and I have marked in and read those changes here. In the packet, you have copies of the original charts, and if you'd like to follow along and make the changes in pencil, you may. We are going to update these ourselves next week, and so you don't need to do that if you don't need it immediately. Let's start with a chart that shows the FY87 budget shortfall problem and solutions. Starting here, we have no change in the budget reserve fund that has been added to this year's revenue available. It's already been done. We've made no change in our budget, although the House has slightly increased the amount available for expenditure, that is, the revenues available are unchanged. The current budget is... We have made no change to that, but if we assume that the House Bill 113 was adopted, which shoves the FY88 capital ahead 1 year, we would reduce this, and if we make the changes for the supplementals that have occurred, by about $180 million or so, and in this amount, instead of being $2,391,000,000, becomes $2,180,000,000, largely as a result of pushing the FY87 capital forward a year. That leaves you with a surplus then of $18 million, which if you add the Bradley Lake funding change, or however that's going to be handled, gives you a total surplus of $68 million. Now, let us assume that you decide to follow the governor's suggestion and create a buffer fund this year with $250 million in it. That would then mean that you could take the $68 million from surplus 87 and take $182 million of permanent fund earnings, of permanent fund reserves, I should say, and that would create the $250 million buffer the governor has requested. That would leave in the permanent fund reserves a total of $334 million that could presumably be used in next year's, in funding next year's budget. I'll leave these here after I'm done, so if people want to...
Before you leave that particular sheet up there, Our balance for FY87 is only $18 million, and where we get ours is, if starting with a deficit of $174 million, we've also passed the bill with supplementals of $20 million, then if you move the capital budget by the delaying the effective date, then you leave $163 million plus the $50 for Bradley, mm-hmm. if that did come back out of mm-hmm. rules. So that's the difference there, was only $18 million, mm-hmm. and we, between our figures and yours, were $68 million difference there.
Well, I understand those. That there are those differences. I think those come from different conventions about how you want to use it. Marla Berg, I think, understands the differences between these two. Let's move ahead then to FY88. In the 88 budget, let's start here with the revenue available. At the 30th percentile, we still have $1.527 billion available. Pushing the capital ahead brings this figure up from $1.925 to $2.089 million, and that leaves a shortfall of, if we assume that the loan closeouts here, which we've changed from $26 million to $32 million, is adopted, leaves a shortfall of $514 million, assuming none of the revenue enhancements were adopted. If none of the revenue enhancements were adopted, and if the $514 million gap was to be plugged with permanent fund reserves, that would leave for FY88 a remaining budget gap of $180 million. Now, this body has already adopted the ELF, so that really could be subtracted from there, but it would be, and the ELF as it stands right now is actually $88 million if you look at the, if you adopt the committee if the Senate were to adopt the bill that passed the House, since there's a little bit of FY87 money there as well. So we would have a remaining budget gap if all of the permanent fund reserves were used, all of the remaining reserves, of about $100 million, a little less than $100 million, actually closer to $90 million. That, of course, is where we see the income tax fitting in. Now, of course, there is this buffer fund, if you were to have created it, of $250 million. You could, of course, raid the buffer fund again, and that could certainly fill this FY88 budget gap and would leave a remaining buffer fund of approximately $150 million. So you would then go into FY89 with some reserves. So there's clearly no question that a budget that will work can be fashioned in FY88 without the income tax. I'm not sure you can do it without the income tax and the ELF without the gasoline tax or all those things, but we'll get back to that in a moment. Let's see where that leaves us, though, in FY89 if we were to do that. I had to change these charts, but because the numbers are about the same, looking at approximately $1.55 billion for revenue, looking at approximately, and these are rough numbers, $1.9 billion for a budget, if we don't have the income tax and the ELF, remember, well, let's assume we have the ELF, and let's assume that we do have the license and fee increases. We still have about a $350 million gap here, and if we have not adopted an income tax, if the state has not adopted an income tax and decides, oh my gosh, we got to FY89, we got a problem here after all, particularly as we would if the revenues were to go down, for example, and if we have used the balance of the buffer, what we need from the buffer to fill the remaining gap in FY87, we have here a buffer with about $150 million in it and a gap here of about $250 million. Because that's what you'd have left to fill here if you adopted these and this and this, the ELF postponement and the license and fee increases. Well, if you adopt an income tax in FY89, you only fill about $85 million of that gap, because you can only collect, if you adopt in FY 1988 session for FY89, the income tax, you only get a half year's revenue in FY89 because you can't get it in place in time to collect more. not to mention the political and practical difficulties of adopting an income tax in an election year. So I'm going to stop there on the fiscal issues and see if there are any questions that I can answer, and then go on to the economic impacts.
Yes, Representative Rieger.
I guess I'd like to go all the way back to your first chart to
yes, sir.
Question the starting point. You know, I remember the sheets that were handed out at the start of the year, and I have a computer printout that's probably about a half or three quarters of an inch thick, which lists appropriations which have unexpended and obligated balances and unexpended and unobligated balances on them. There's three columns. One, what's been spent, what's been encumbered, what hasn't yet even been encumbered. And if my memory's right, about $400 million is encumbered but not yet spent, and another $527 million is unexpended and unencumbered. And I'm wondering if you have a forecast of how much out of that total of $928 million you expect to be needing in cash for spending out of those old appropriations in fiscal year 1988?
The answer is I do not have such a forecast.
Do you think it would be anywhere near $928 million?
I have no idea. I truly don't. Now, to the general thrust of your question, though, there's certainly other places that one could fill these gaps from, and repealing prior appropriations is, of course, one of those possibilities, which thus far I think the legislature has generally not been anxious to do, it would appear. But I would leave that to Commissioner Malone to expand on and perhaps give you a more
Commissioner, detail. The representative is talking about the numbers that he has seen in the state's annual report, which states there's approximately $537 million in the capital, and also the 400 figure that he's talking about, unobligated. And those two numbers are on one sheet there, and that's, would you like to respond to him on that?
Mr. Chairman, I think there's several considerations in looking at an answer to Representative Rieger. One is that, of course, the overall amount of money that's coming into the state for fiscal 87 is much less than what we'd originally anticipated. I mean, we're talking, when the budget was put together, people were hoping for revenues close to $2.5 billion, and we won't see $2 billion in the current fiscal year. And so one factor is that, you know, overall, on a cash basis, revenues are down. Secondly, that of the unexpended, unobligated balances that we have, I'm not 100% sure of the numbers in the report that you're talking about, but we have both. If you're talking about all general funds, because we have both federal receipts that we haven't received. I mean, accounts receivable and general funds. Those were as of the financial report for the end of the last fiscal year, and we're most of the way through this fiscal year now, and we are spending down the accounts. I don't have a current accounting of that, but we are spending them down. And then thirdly, the ability of the government or the executive branch of government to restrict the timing of the expenditures on a for policy reasons, I think, is pretty much severely circumscribed by the Supreme Court decision that was just issued. In other words, there's no way we can put the clamps on the money if the money needs to be spent and it's not there. About the only answer that the governor has would be to exercise some sort of immediate restriction, call the legislature into session. So what I'm saying is the appropriations that were previously made certainly can't be reached by the executive, and we won't have, as far as I know, any way to crank them into this year's budget
if the revenues don't materialize. I mean, we're short hundreds of millions of dollars in the state revenues, so that's not a complete answer to your question. How much will, what will be the balance at the end of the year? How much cash balance will we have at the end, of the year? Is a question I probably could answer, but I can't give you an answer of how much of that is unobligated.
Right. The 928 that I referred to was all general funds under that report, and it does seem like, yeah, I wish it were true, but it does seem unlikely that all of that would be released in the next calendar year. But I was just, really the point I wanted to draw is that when there's a shortfall, when the boldface type shortfall wedge there, is a shortfall in being able to have cash placed in an account side by side with an appropriation that won't be spent, not a shortfall to have cash to fund encumbrances and, you know, payrolls and all that are going to occur in the next year or two. And I just wanted to draw that distinction to you.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, there is a distinction between a deficit from an accounting function and a lack of money to meet the bills, and the states face both those problems during the current fiscal year. In either case, I mean, facing either situation, we either have to have additional money from someplace or we have to reduce expenditures. To reduce them legally, we require legislative action. I mean, we require a reduction in the actual level of appropriations, at least to the extent that the statutory requirements for the expenditures of the money have to be met. And so I guess what I'm really saying is that there's a very limited amount of money that we can reasonably be carrying forward from the present year to the next year. And I think the point that Mr. Erickson is trying to make is that we might be able to defer the imposition of an income tax for a year at a relatively high risk to the state public service budget. In a second year, the risk becomes even higher. In fact, it's not clear that we can forego it without major budget reductions. And as we go on using our reserves, we increase the risk to the ability to provide public services, and face an increasing chance, of course, that that some sort of dramatic action would have to be taken that be at the public's expense. And I think that finally comes back to the stability question. And that's part of what's inherent in this measure, of course.
Jeremy, I just have one last question at this point, and that's on the FY89 pie chart. There's a $1.55 billion figure. What percentile of revenue does that represent for FY89?
30%. Well, this is a general generic figure to represent revenues, approximate revenues for 89, 90, and 91. Those are roughly the 30th percentile. I could there. Each year, of course, is somewhat different, but they're about that level.
That's what it is. Yeah. Okay. I can double check. I thought that the FY89 30th percentile was over 1.6. I guess my memory was.
I think it is, in fact. But also, I think the total budget estimate for FY89 is also expected to be a little bit higher than this, bringing the budget down a little slowly as we pass through those years.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The governor has indicated that his desire is to see that the budget be in a memorandum to all of you that he has two basic things that he thinks are needed out of this budget. One is a balanced state budget based on a realistic revenue estimates at the 30th percentile, and number two, a budget reserve fund of no less than $250 million. Now, he hasn't said that, hey, I've got to have the income tax. But this is our proposal to get from here to there. And I think that leaves the legislature a good deal of flexibility, but frankly, we see the income tax as a critical element in reaching these goals, to which the governor has indicated that he would use his full constitutional authority to ensure that those goals are met. That, I assume, although I assume means that it is constitutional authority to veto elements of the budget if there are not adequate funds to give us to meet these two criteria. If that is the case, if that occurs, we then have to compare the effects on the economy of a cut in spending in place of the revenues that would have been achieved had an income tax been adopted, or had the ELF proposal, for example, been adopted. Now, it's our contention that the ELF proposal results in no loss of jobs to Alaska. And we think we're on solid economic ground in making that assertion. That is not the case with the income tax. If an income tax is adopted, there is no question that it will cause jobs in the state of Alaska to be lost. There will be a reduction in employment as a consequence of that. And the opponents of the income tax make a great deal of that point. We don't dispute it, although we might argue about the numbers involved. In State Affairs Committee, a panel of economists testified, and these numbers represent the general consensus of that panel of distinguished economists. They are fairly simple. If a full year of income tax is collected in a calendar year, we can expect about 2,900 jobs to be lost. In part, we get some breaks from an income tax, in part because about $50 million of it, we expect, will be paid by the feds in reductions in federal income taxes that Alaska taxpayers will benefit from as a consequence of paying the tax. Roughly another $25 million will be collected from non-residents, which will have relatively minor economic impacts in Alaska. The $175 million that actually comes out of the total $250 million that actually comes out of Alaskans' pockets will cause them to spend less at the grocery store, spend less with other Alaska merchants, and working its way through the economy, through the multiplier, will probably result in a reduced demand and the loss of about 2,900 jobs. Depends in part on factors that we're not certain about, but we believe that the accuracy of this estimate is relatively high, probably plus or minus 15%. If that $250 million is achieved by spending cuts, then the loss of jobs will, of course, depend on where the spending cuts occur. But if they occur in the places that appear reasonably likely, namely in transfers to municipalities, transfers to individuals, and to a certain extent in the rest of the agency budget, it is our estimate that almost 7,000 jobs will be lost. So we're really not looking at 2,900 jobs being lost to the income tax in a vacuum. We're looking at a very severe negative effect if spending cuts result from the failure to adopt an income tax. Those are the two points, Mr. Chairman, that I wanted to make, and if there are questions on those points, I'd be glad to answer them. Otherwise, I would turn things back to my colleague.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Representative Davis first. And
actually, my original question has been answered, but just one question about the $250 million. Is that, I've heard various figures on that. Is that based on income that is received today, or is that from an old figure? Is that?
We expect to collect in FY89 $255 million from the original bill if it were to be adopted. We would collect in FY89 $255 million. And if the committee substitute were adopted, we would collect $249 million, I believe. Those estimates are based on a declining economy, declining personal income, declining employment. In other words, they are conservative estimates. Frankly, I think we'll probably collect a little more than that. But I also think it's proper and appropriate to be conservative when we're making these kinds of estimates. Better to be pleasantly surprised than unpleasantly surprised in those circumstances.
Yes, Representative Boyer, then Rieger.
Thank you. You had indicated that the income tax at $250 million would depress the purchasing appetite of the public, and I'm wondering how long that lasts. I can see it in the initial bite that's taken by the income tax, perhaps a year or 18 months, but doesn't that appetite rebound as you continue to move through time? I'm wondering how long that depression or that loss of jobs stays with us. or whether or not we regain those jobs fairly quickly as we regain our spending appetite.
Well, those we expect that as the economy grows, those jobs will be regained, or other jobs of a similar number will be regained. But if we start out with about $9 billion of personal income in Alaska, and if we are continuing to take out of that on its own, so it's not so much a rebounding of the appetite, it's a rebounding that we expect to occur in the economy as a whole. And incidentally, I pass on some good news. I think it's good news. The recent employment figures from the Department of Labor indicate to me, anyhow, that the economy is not declining nearly as rapidly as we had expected it to in the early parts of this year. And while it's too early to draw any definitive conclusions, it looks like the recession we're in may bottom out a bit sooner than the economist has been telling us recently.
So the assumption is that it's money out of the total disposable income pool and not necessarily spending appetite, lack of a better word.
The notion of an appetite there is perhaps a good one, but it tends to work the other way. When people's incomes are reduced, as by an income tax, there is a tendency not to reduce consumption as quickly as that would suggest, because the spending appetites, if you want to use that word, and I think it's a good one, take a while to get cranked down. And so people tend to withdraw funds from savings or to borrow to maintain the lifestyle to which they've become accustomed. I'm certainly, my salary was cut by 10% last July, and I certainly have noticed that in my own personal finances, that you have to make adjustments, and it takes you a while to make those adjustments in your consumption.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Rieger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just one last question on these two. Following along on these two pie charts, I noticed that farther on in this packet there's a little bit of talk about permanent fund dividends. How many jobs are lost by taking the equivalent of dollar amount out of the permanent fund dividend distribution?
I don't have those numbers at my fingertips, but I can supply them to you. We have that data, and in fact, I'll just dig it out of my folder here and as soon as I sit down and provide you with that estimate.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Frank.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Greg, you're saying that the effects of the tax be less detrimental than the cut in the economy, cut in the
spending.
In spending. If you took that logic and turned it around and said, well, why don't we double the tax and spend $250 million more in state spending, it seems like your logic would lead to a conclusion that would further stimulate the economy.
And that is exactly what it would do, up to at least as long until you got to, as long as you remain in the region that we're talking about here. But 2.5% of personal income, if you take that, it has that effect. If we took another 2.5% of personal income, and put it into state spending, it probably would, in fact, I'm sure it would, could be spent in a way that would create more jobs on the spending side that would be lost on the taxing side. Now, you can't keep doing that forever because people's spending habits change when you get down to taking 10% of their income, and the job loss is likely to rise significantly higher at the margin. That, I suppose, makes the point that the purpose of a tax is not to create jobs. I'm presenting this information to show those effects. Clearly, if state spending can be reduced beyond the levels that it has already been reduced, that is not something that is necessarily to be avoided just because some jobs would be lost as a consequence of it.
One other
Continue.
Question. You suggested that the governor might choose to veto the budget if the legislature didn't provide. Are we on telecom?
No, we're not on telecom.
If the legislature didn't provide a budget reserve account of some sort, and to me, I can appreciate the governor's desire to have a reserve account, but I don't see the inherent wisdom or logic in cutting the operating budget now so that you don't have to maybe cut it later if revenues fall. I mean, if it happens, you'll take the worst when it happens, but why cut it now just in case it might happen? Chairman?
Yes. Yeah, obviously, comments on that. I think that one of the things that we faced, for example, during the current fiscal year was a reduction in the, the early part of the fiscal year by executive action, in that case there, but of the funds that were available to municipalities, which in some cases dramatically affected their local budgets. And I think that the idea that the governor is approaching the budget with is trying to build in some stability, and that if in fact there are additional revenues accrued during the fiscal year over and above what the budget requires, that then we'd be in the happy situation of looking to put those where they might be most needed, rather than to face the alternative, which might be partway through the budget year when some of the money's already spent, to have to revise the budget. And it's a philosophy of stability. That's a reason that the governor's basically proposing a budget that is so much lower than the current year's budget. Now, ultimately, of course, the appropriation level that is reached as a legislative decision, and as to what the governor may or may not veto, I think are questions he's going to have to sort through when he sees the whole package. But I think what Greg was saying is that if we assume, just for the purposes of economic illustration, that we had a reduction in the budget equal to the revenue that would be raised in the income tax, then the economists, at least, pretty much have reached the conclusion you'd lose a lot more jobs by reducing the budget than by levying a relatively minor income tax. And I think that's a point that Greg was reaching to.
Mr. Chairman, well,
go ahead.
Did you want to respond to him?
I'm sorry.
What's that?
Are you all done?
Yeah, I'm done.
Let me have Representative Brown then. Yes.
Thank you. I'm looking at Figure 10 in the packet of charts that you passed out regarding the tax rates, and I wanted to explore your thoughts on what's been described to me by constituents as discrimination against single people that results from, I think, the combination of the way the tax is structured coupled with the payment of permanent fund dividends. And I tend to agree with the administration's analysis of the need for additional revenues, and was just wondering whether you see any ways that we could modify this proposal to make it less discriminatory on single people.
Mr. Chairman, what I would like to do is, this might be a good juncture, and I don't want to avoid answering the question, but it might be a good juncture to go through the specifics of the bill and its incidents, which is the second phase of the presentation. It would answer that question, and maybe others that might be pending at this time, without addressing them one at a time. And then if the question still remains, we could answer it if that would be agreeable. I'd that's a fair way to approach it.
Yeah, my bill is scheduled to come up in another committee at 3:30, so I don't know how long it'll take to do this.
The short answer, Representative Brown, is yes, the bill could be restructured. It wouldn't be particularly difficult, although generally a significant restructuring of that nature would require some additional staff work. We did contemplate at the outset a bill that treated married couples and single individuals identically. The structure you have there in front of you in that chart 10 is really follows the model of the federal tax and provides the same kinds of differences between tax treatment of married and unmarried individuals that is suggested on the basis of if you were to try and model a tax that was similar to the one that the federal government has adopted.
Mr. Chairman, basically those issues underlie the reason this tax model was taken, and I spend a lot of time in that early stages, and I think the best way to cover that those kinds of issues would be go through the specifics of the model in the bill, which doesn't take very long, and then if there are remaining questions, we'd answer them directly.
Continue.
Okay, if you don't mind, Mr. Chairman, what I'd like to do would be to have...
Can I ask Steve Rieger's question first?
Oh, sure.
If $250 million were taken out of the economy by an income tax, we'd lose about 2,900 jobs. If $250 million is taken out of the economy by an equivalent reduction of permanent fund dividends, the job loss is expected to be slightly higher than from the job loss resulting from an income tax. There's three reasons for that. One is we don't get to export part of our permanent fund dividends to non-residents or to very many non-residents. Actually, we do export some of our dividends to people who are living here during the qualifying period but have left. But most of this non-resident effect is an actual effect in Alaska in the case of a reduced dividend. Secondly, the federal tax bite is a little bit export to the federal taxes are less because the people who do most of the paying of the income taxes tend to be high incomes, people in high income tax brackets who can export some of that state tax bite to their federal, to the federal government. On the permanent fund dividends, it's much more evenly distributed across the population, and consequently, many of the people who receive the permanent fund dividends don't pay that much federal tax. Thirdly, and this is really the most important reason that the equivalent amount of money taken out of the economy via a reduction in dividends would cost more jobs, is that people in the lower income categories who largely pay any income tax have what economists call a high propensity to consume locally. They don't save very much money. They can't take a trip to Hawaii. They don't buy a great many things as from outside as do the people who are of low incomes and who concentrate their purchases in the necessities of life. And as a consequence, the employment multiplier of low-income spending tends to be higher than the employment multiplier of people with high incomes. I'm not getting into some technical detail, but the answer is there would be slightly more jobs lost if an equivalent amount of money were taken out of the dividend program than there would be if it would be coming out of an income tax. And by slightly, we aren't exactly sure how much more, but my estimate would be about 3,500 jobs. Scott Goldsmith at the University of Alaska has estimated slightly higher.
Yes, Representative Frank, continue.
Thank you. Greg, we have a little bit of history to go on here. It seems to me the budget was up as high as 1.965 or something like that in our highest year. I'm not sure, you probably know off the top of your head. But we're now spending at a rate of 1.7 in the operating budget, Governor Sheffield's instructions. That's over $235 million. And I'm wondering what kind of empirical evidence is out there and how it relates to your projection of losing 6,700 jobs.
The results aren't all in on that yet in terms of the because you have to wait a year or more before you can really look back and reliably associate those two. But so far, the models seem to be holding up very well in terms of the jobs we've lost are being related in the models to what you just described. Now, we're not just relating it to operating spending, we're relating it to all spending, and that is, there are very different impacts, of course, in the capital budget and the operating budget and the loan programs.
If I could follow up on that. We've cut the budget from our highest spending years, maybe as much as a billion, I don't know.
We had a budget that was almost, I believe, over $4 billion at one point.
Some of it went to the permanent fund, but maybe not, I don't know. Anyway, I would submit that the bulk of our jobs lost in the economy have been the result of reductions in oil spending and in capital spending, because if you look at the number of operating budget jobs lost over the last 2 years, we certainly haven't lost 10% of them. We've lost a few hundred, I think 400 or 500 at the most. And I think that the case has perhaps been made more dramatic than it ought to be, ought to have been made. I just don't believe that the effect is going to be as bad on the job loss as you're suggesting, and I don't think the evidence is there to support it, but that's a good gut feel.
Well, Mr. Chairman, there's certainly room for differences of opinion in these areas of economics. Scott Goldsmith, Professor Goldsmith at the University of Alaska, who, as far as I'm aware, doesn't have any particular axe to grind in this debate, indicates that in his calculations, the minimum impact from a spending cut, if you concentrated it all in capital, would be 2,700 jobs. Now, we don't have $250 million of capital to cut right now, so he indicates that the maximum job loss, if you concentrated it in those operating areas and those income transfer areas to low-income people, which would be the places where you get the biggest adverse bang for the buck, if you will, would be 8,600 jobs from a $250 million cut. So there's certainly room for disagreement, but it's not my opinion that we've pumped up these numbers. I think we've been conservative.
Representative Wallace?
Thank you. A question to the commissioner, please. In the previous income tax upon the state, there was a section that allowed for $10 to go to the education fund. Is that included in this bill, anything like that? Mr. Chairman, what is the intent of the chair on this bill?
The intent of the chair, as I stated earlier, that it's my intention that the chair is going to move this particular bill out of committee once we hear testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I wonder if we can include language to have some of that money go to education.
Pardon me?
I would like to have language included in the bill to have some of the income tax money go to education.
Representative Larson?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I believe Representative Wallace is talking about the school tax that we had previously. In some ways, if my recollection is correct, that was kind of a misnomer in that $10 went to the general fund. It didn't go to schools directly. But, that's another source of revenue that I think we should be looking at. So I don't think necessarily that this is the vehicle, but it should be probably in a separate piece of legislation.
Commissioner?
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, I would like to, for the benefit of the committee, have Mr. Hansen briefly go through the model in the bill, why it's written that way, how it would work, so that if there are questions on that, and there was one so far, I think, that we could cover.
Okay.
Is that agreeable?
That's agreeable.
Don Hansen, I'm with the Department of Revenue. I'd like to just take a minute, Mr. Chairman, show you how the tax would work and just give an estimate of how much it's going to cost the taxpayers that are going to be paying it. And I think probably one of the easiest ways to do it is to actually show you the return that we've mocked up here. And one of the criteria that the governor gave us was to make this a very simple tax, and I think we've accomplished that. The return itself is in your handout. It's on page 5, if you want to follow with me. I'll just go through with it to show you how it's going to work. It's going to be a one-page return, and the filing statuses will be the same as on your federal return. And one of the questions that the representative asked was how we could perhaps change the disparity in the single person's tax liability. That could be accomplished in the filing status at breakpoint. As the bill is now, a single filer will pay tax on the lower rate on the first $30,000 of income, and then the higher rate at 5.7 would be over 30. So we call that the bracket breakpoint. So a single bracket breakpoint would be $30,000. Married filing joint is $50,000. Married filing separately is $25,000. And head of household or surviving spouse is $40,000. So if the committee wanted to make an adjustment in that area, that would be a simple way of doing it, which wouldn't take much effort, other than we would probably have to recompute the rates, because it all kind of is, it's all on a big model, and if you make one change here, you have to change other things.
Yes, Ripson Frank.
You said you'd have to change the rates?
Correct, because you have certain income percentages in a single bracket, and if you change the threshold from 30,000 to say 40,000, you're going to be collecting less tax from a certain percentage of income. So we would might have to increase the rates accordingly. You see how it
so you start
the same revenue.
To produce the same revenue.
Mr. Chairman, then if I could
just continue.
So you start out with the amount of revenue you wanted to collect.
That's
and
correct.
Figured out how much of a rate you'd have to.
That's correct. That's how this model works. We started with a $250 million revenue goal, and then based the bill and what we've done with our tax structure based on that revenue goal.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, just to elaborate briefly, there are two kind of themes behind this bill. One is that that we would have an income tax that basically anybody that had enough income, you might say, to live on would pay some tax. And secondly, that it would be a progressive tax. Then after that, the fundamental question was to make it as simple as possible. And then, of course, wanted to raise a certain amount of revenue, and so that affected all the different elements of the bill, including the breakpoints and where the tax rates changed for different people. But those are that's a theory behind the bill itself as written.
To follow that up, for instance, the committee substitute has taken out the longevity bonus and permanent fund dividend. If we wanted to achieve the same revenue goal, we could increase the upper rate from 5.7 to 6.1. That would make up that $6 million difference there. If the committee wanted to do that, that would be one way to do it. To continue on now, that's the one. Okay. We're going to start here on line one, and this is total income. And this is, we have adopted all the income provisions of the Internal Revenue Code Section 61. So we have the benefit of all that case law and all that history, and we're not starting with a new concept on our income. And this, in 1986, this total income was line 23 on the federal return. So it's very simple for a person to prepare their return. If they file their federal return, they take their federal return and they start right here on line 1, which would be line 23 on their federal return. After that, we make several adjustments, which is line 2. We would add in the federal cost of living allowance, the COLA allowance that federal employees receive. That's 25% cost of living allowance they get. We would add that into income. We'd also add interest in that's exempt from federal tax. That would be our interest on state and municipal bonds. We would add that in also, as the bill is outlined. We also make adjustments that take out from income on line 5 would be penalty for early withdrawal of savings. Line 6 is alimony paid, and the reason behind the alimony is the recipient of that alimony is including that in their income. These are traditional adjustments that are made on the federal return on what to arrive at adjusted gross income, AGI adjustments. Now the committee substitute bill will be having two line items here for the longevity bonus, if that was included on the federal return, and also, of course, the permanent fund dividend. We'd be backing that out here also. Interest on U.S. government securities, that would be interest on U.S. government bonds. We cannot tax that. The federal government doesn't allow states to tax that. And line 8 is for Alaska tax refunds, and those would be refunds that were claimed on the federal return as income that were written off in previous years. After we come making those adjustments, we come down to our Alaska adjusted gross income. From there, we have our personal exemptions, which are $3,000 a person, and those dependents and exemptions would be the same as your federal. For instance, a family of four would have $12,000 exempted from income. The first $12,000 at $3,000 per person, four exemptions. So that's it. And from there, we go down to the tax, 3.2 and 5.7 as it is. So it's a very simple return. It's not going to cost a person a lot of money to have a preparer do it. It's one page, and that's essentially going to be it. We've also, on our form, included a line item for a permanent fund dividend checkoff. And I know there's been a lot of those already introduced this year, but what that could be is a person could prepay their 89 tax, if this was instituted in 88, by on their permanent fund dividend, making a check and having a certain amount allocated for the state, and we could handle that in our department. And essentially, that's the return, and that's how the bill works. It's a very simple tax, and we believe that it's probably one of the most progressive taxes in the United States. We tried to design it that way.
Representative Boyer.
Just out of curiosity, what would the tax generate if you just, instead of taking gross income, if you started with the federal adjusted gross?
Okay, it just depends on the rates. See, we could design the tax to raise any revenue you
want. If it's designed exactly the way it's designed with your threshold levels, but instead of using your Alaska adjusted gross, you
go
use
to the federal adjusted gross? Okay. Those items that are adjusted on the federal return are, for instance, your
mortgages,
IRA contributions, moving expenses. They're not a lot of big ticket items. I can't give you a figure, but it isn't going to be substantially less. Okay?
Right. One of the concerns I've heard from people is, you know, there isn't a deduction here for your home mortgage interest and things like that, that if we could modify the tax to do that, it would make it more palatable for many, many people. And so that's why I'm interested.
Those kind of adjustments actually aren't adjustments. They're itemized deductions. And our bill has no deductions or credits. And if the committee wanted to examine those kind of impacts, we certainly could do it and tell you. That is the largest deduction that is taken, is the home mortgage interest deduction. It's probably one of the most controversial deductions. And the decision has to be made, do you want to subsidize or allow that particular deduction? And if that's the goal, we can certainly come back to you and tell you.
Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure I want that, but I'd certainly like to be armed with the numbers so that I could argue.
Provide that for you.
I'd appreciate that.
Representative Frank? I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to comment on it. Like, that's a major deduction for both people, most people. And what in this bill, what we tried to do is set a relatively high personal exemption and say, okay, that's it, because that treats people pretty much equally. And whereas if you get into the business saying, well, this group will give deductions to homeowners but not to renters, but to balance it out, we'll raise the rates overall, the people that are renting get hit twice, right? So we said, let's stay away from that, go with a single personal exemption. And if the legislature wants to dive into all the policy questions that are contained in the federal legislation, we'll just do them one at a time. But we elected to leave them out of the bill.
Essentially, what we have here is a flat tax with two rates. And in some ways, this is the Tax Reform Act that President Reagan promised we delivered. That's kind of what we're saying. I just want to take a minute and show you briefly.
Just a minute. I got Representative Frank.
Oh, excuse me.
Well, this is probably even more appropriate now than you started to explain a little bit some of the characteristics of the tax. You used the word progressive a few minutes ago.
Yes.
I was going to ask you to define that because...
Okay. What we consider a progressive tax is a tax that looks at the ability to pay. The higher income you make, the more ability you have to pay, the higher rate you're going to pay at. That's what we consider a progressive tax. And I think it's...
Isn't that the opposite of a flat tax?
To a certain extent it is. However, because we have the two rates, okay, we are having a very progressive tax. And it's when we compare it to what other states have, it's probably one of the most progressive taxes in the United States.
In other words, it's all the taxes in the tax systems in the United States, it's designed to take more from the higher income people and exempt the lower income people. Is that what you mean by progressive?
Yes, and I can't say that is especially true what you just said, but that is
one of the higher your income, the higher the tax rate.
That's correct. Exactly. The higher the effective rate. Because you merge those two rates together. And as a matter of fact, in the handout we gave you, if you look on page 6, it shows you the effective tax rates. And you can see that if you make 0 to 10,000, your effective tax rate is, let's see if I can figure it out here, 0.83. And if you, this is all returns, and if you make over 400,000, it's 5.24%. So that's what we've designed, and that's supposed to be how it works, and we feel that's how it will work.
Okay, then how about our overall effective rates relative to other states?
Okay.
Is this going to be a high or low or medium or what?
On page 7, we have the tax rates in other states, and just to summarize that, there's 43 states that have an income tax. And based on our effective rates here, we would be the 14th lowest. In other words, 30 states would have higher effective rates than what our plan is here. Okay?
Okay. That gets me to my next question, which is, if you go back up here a few lines, which say the credit for taxes paid in other states.
Correct.
I think one of the most compelling arguments for having the income tax is that it, in some way, gets at some of the non-resident workforce.
Absolutely.
But we appear to be giving them a credit here for the taxes they pay in other states.
No. This is the resident return. And this would be the resident worker that works in other states. And we would actually have a non-resident return. Okay. And the system we've developed is far superior to our methodology of taxation for non-residents in prior years. Whereas in prior years, we taxed non-residents at the lowest rates possible. We sourced the income, okay? We looked at their Alaska source income and taxed it. We didn't combine income. What this bill does, it looks at their total income and taxes that income equally to residents. We apportion the tax, not sourcing the income.
In other words, if you were an Alaskan and you were paying taxes on $50,000 of income, you pay at a certain rate on $50,000 worth of income. If you're a non-resident working in Alaska and you made $50,000 during the year and $25,000 of that is in Alaska, you're going to be paying at the same rate as the Alaskan is on the $25,000. You're going to be paying at the higher bracket because your higher total income puts you in that bracket instead of only counting the Alaska income, which would put you in a much lower effective tax rate. So that's the change in this bill that we think is a fair way, by the way, of you know, we're treating everyone the same. If they're in the same tax bracket, we don't care where they got the money, they pay at the same rate, but they don't pay on any more income than they would actually earn in Alaska.
This form of modified apportionment.
Yes, exactly. We're apportioning their tax based on their income. Okay.
No separate accounting.
No, exactly. Okay.
Right.
Okay. And this line 14, I might add that this credit is again for residents that work out of state that pay income tax in other states, and that's going to be limited to what the tax would have been in the state. We have a neat little formula to do that worked out. Okay.
Representative Brown.
Thank you. I'm looking at page 6 and the effective tax rates, and I'm still just not clear why it is that the single person pays a higher effective tax rate in every category.
Why that works mechanically is because their bracket breakpoint, where they're going to be taxed at the higher rates, is at $30,000, as opposed to a married filing joint, which is at $50,000. That's how it works. Why it works, when we designed this bill, again, we looked at what the federal tax policy is as far as where they have their bracket breakpoints, and we use those same numbers, those same percentages, to determine where our bracket breakpoints are going to come into place. Again, if
do you think that's
reasonable?
Yeah. Do you think
discriminates
against single people?
No, I don't. Personally. It's a policy decision, which the policy, you know, that's what you guys decide. But I don't personally know.
Crimson Frank.
I guess it's clear that it discriminates against single people. The question is whether it's fair to discriminate against single
people. Yeah. It's, that's a question.
Why do you think it's fair to discriminate against single people?
I'm just thinking about my wife right now. No, I shouldn't have said that. I don't think we are discriminating against people, single people, in that I don't have an answer for that, but I don't feel we're discriminating.
Was this people. Discussed at all in the administration's deliberations on the proposal?
Yes.
Oh, yes.
A lot. And we have quite a bit of discussion written up in summary papers on that, and I just can't come out with an answer right now. I'm sure there's a good one somewhere.
They were all married. Mr. Malone?
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, in fact, there was a substantial lot of discussion. In fact, it's one of the points that struck me about the initial approach is that why do we have to discriminate against any particular marital status? And looking into the actual administration of the tax laws and the selection of the rates and how they're going to apply, one of the reasons for making this decision was that it actually, because of where the how the federal returns are prepared, it makes it a great deal easier to administer this tax by setting these changes where they are right now. It doesn't mean we couldn't enforce the tax by changing the breakpoints, obviously. We could. But that's one of the considerations in it. And the other is that when you make the change, if you make the change and want to keep the change revenue neutral, obviously you're going to be raising rates someplace else. And so after going through that whole discussion a couple times, the people in the administration, which mainly was me, and the governor, decided it wasn't worth it to make that change. Maybe the legislature would disagree, of course.
Right, Representative Brown.
On the point of the necessity of keeping it revenue neutral, it seemed like from the charts we went through earlier that even in the out years, 3, 4, 5 years from now, do you feel that we absolutely have to have the full amount that's projected to be raised by this?
Mr. Chairman, I can't answer that question. I think that the theory behind the income tax is to add another element to our overall state revenues, one that is more predictable than our main source of revenue is. It would be affected by that, obviously. But and the level, for example, the amount of money that would be raised by this tax is substantially less than what would have been raised by the previous income tax if it were still on the books. It would have raised about $400 million a year now, contrasted with this tax. Now, that's one of the considerations that we looked at. If we went back to the same effective tax rates, why not just do that again? And decided not to do that, to place Alaska lower down, and not necessarily to say that we're going to use the income tax, in effect, you might say, to pump up the budget. Whether the total amount might be needed in future years or whether minor adjustments that might be reflected by changing the rates, the income levels at which the rates change are essential 3 or 4 years in the future, of course, is something like the economist's projection of the jobs. I mean, we got like a couple hundred thousand jobs in Alaska, and I don't know if they really can call it within 0.5%. Maybe they can. But I think their relative effects of what they're talking about are probably right, and the relative effects of making a change in the revenues from the income tax of $4 or $5 million by changing breakpoints can be guessed at just as well by you or me today, what its effects are in the budget as a legislator sitting in your place 4 years from now. What is $6 million worth in the budget? Well, it's hard to say. If it's my project, it's a lot, but otherwise it might not count.
Continue.
Mr. Chairman, I'll just take a minute just to show you the bottom line, so to speak, how much we're going to pay. In this instance, on $25,000 worth of income, a family of four with $3,000 exemption is actually going to pay $415 in state income tax. And as a comparison here, I think they were using this for other purposes, but I'll show you that also. The permanent fund dividends would be $3,188 in this family of four. A married couple will pay $607 in income tax, and a single person will pay $705 in income tax. And just to show you how that works on the higher end, where we would have the bracket breakpoint kick in now, family of four would be paying $1,251 if they earn income of $50,000, and they would receive $3,188 in permanent fund dividends. Married couple, tax liability would be $1,425, and a single individual would be $1,930. Also, in the handout we gave you, there's a summary tax liability per taxable income. So if a person on page 8 wanted to say, well, how much am I going to pay, is all you'd have to do is look at this chart, and it will tell you specifically what your tax liability would be. And is there any other questions I can answer?
Further questions? Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Is there any other members have any further questions on this bill? Is there anybody from the public that would like to testify on the bill? At this time, the chair moves committee substitute for House Bill number 154, State Affairs Audit Committee. Is there any objection? Yes.
In thinking about this, you know, I've been a supporter of this proposal, and in the last week I've been contacted by a lot of people in my district, several specifically raising issue about, or there have been a number of issues raised about it, but one that I'm concerned about is the effect of the tax on single people, because it seems to me that it does discriminate against single people. And I just wonder, do we really need to accept the federal tax just for ease of administration? And if the committee would be interested in pursuing that, I would work with the administration to draft an amendment. I don't have an amendment prepared to do that, but I would like to make that attempt to offer that amendment, and I think this committee would be a better forum for that discussion than subsequent opportunities.
I think that particular opportunity still lies in the on the House floor on this piece of legislation. Yes, Representative Rieger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to say I sure don't oppose this bill going out of committee, but I'm not in favor of the bill. And I noticed that in the charts that we've seen and the you know, the flows of funds back and forth that go in there, you know, one of the biggest things that's being tried, that they're trying to do, is to put some extra money into a budget reserve fund. But I think we all know how long a budget reserve fund lasts. We put money into a budget reserve fund last year. The very first thing we did when we got down here was immediately dump it all right back into the general fund. And I think that until there's a new spending limit enacted, which will hold spending constant, increased revenues will lead directly to increased spending. And I think the budget reserve fund will not protect that money from being spent.
The motion is not to reflect what your vote would be on the income tax. It's just the movement of this particular bill from the committee. Representative Frank?
I was just going to say that I'd be happy to work with Representative Brown to do committee work on the floor again.
Mr. Chair. Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman, of course, you know, I certainly am willing to work with people that want to get the information that people might need to support amendments to the legislation insofar as the department's resources can do it. And this issue that's been raised here recently is one that was subject to a lot of discussion by the administration before introduction of the bill, and so the information is available.
If, in fact, this bill does not get to the floor of this particular session, I'll be more than happy to work on your single status in the interim.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And for the record, I would declare a conflict of interest. I'm a single person.
Are you posting notice, Mr. Chairman?
Representative Boyer?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'd be curious to know whether or not the amendment that's being asked for is something that you could make now as we have it before committee. Again, not to prejudice anybody's vote on the thing, but if it's something we could accommodate here and have a vote on that measure today, we would avoid having to deal with it in rules or on the floor. It sounds to me like it's a relatively easy thing, and you probably have the language, if not on the top of your head, fairly close.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes?
It isn't hard, but it's not simple. It affects all the brackets when you do this. The administration of the tax out, it's going to affect all the brackets and the relative places that you make the break points.